The plate had belonged to Mrs. van der Stock, a middle-aged Dutch lady who at the time of its breakage, shortly after 10 minutes to 11 on the Sunday morning, was quite probably laying her table for family luncheon. It had been part of her diary on the day she married Dr. J.P. van der Stock, the distinguished scientist from Utrecht who had brought her out to Batavia some years before on his appointment as director of the colony's magnetic and meteorological observatory. The couple lived in a single-story house attached to the observatory, and on that hot and cloudless Sunday morning, both could not help but notice that something, somewhere, had gone badly awry. First, there was the plate, lying smashed on the marble floor of the dining room. Then, in the living room, Dr. van der Stock himself, reading the Sunday edition of the Java Bode, the word means messenger, found all the windows and doors beginning to rattle and bang. From somewhere to the west came a low, rumbling sound, like that of distant artillery. He got out his pocket watch and noted the time, 10:55 a.m. He walked across to the observatory, noticing immediately that the needles and pens, suspended by their cocoon threads on his magnetic declinometer, were ticking and trembling violently, not in the usual side-to-side sweeps that one might expect from an earthquake, but in a series of buzzing up-and-down motions that didn't register properly on the paper rolling from the drum. The more he thought about it, the more he realised something odd. The vibrations were not so much being felt through his feet as if they had emanated from somewhere deep in the earth. They were, in fact, being felt in the air. True, there were ground tremors and buildings were shaking. This was self-evident. But most of the shaking was coming through the very atmosphere itself. And vibration of this kind was the very particular hallmark of an erupting volcano, not of the subterranean shaking of an earthquake. Later in the day, he would see more commonplace left-to-right activity on his declinometer, but only when the ash had begun to drift down over the city that evening, and then he surmised quite rightly that the magnets were going wild simply because the falling ash was rich in iron, like a blizzard of tiny compasses. For now, though, it was all vibration and rumbling, and the occasional period of low and menacing thuds. Van der Stock knelt down and put his ear to the ground. Nothing. Nothing deep-seated. And what was more, these vibrations were continuing for long, long periods, an hour already with no signs of abating. Earthquake vibrations last for matters of seconds only, a few minutes at the most, followed by periods of quiet and then aftershocks and more movement and mayhem. This was very different. And all of this made him now, at noon on that Sunday, quite certain that he knew what was happening. These particular kinds of vibrations were absolutely typical of those that were caused by a volcano. And so each time a fresh explosion of trembling started again, he noted the time in his official logbook. Had it been an earthquake, there would be less need to catalogue the aftershocks, the timings of which were in any case mathematically predictable. But this was evidence of a volcano somewhere, and the measuring of its palpitations might give some clue as to its future behaviour. All the while, van der Stock was kept busy fending off inquiries from worried Batavians, men and women who flooded to his observatory, even on this sunny Sunday, wanting to know just what was happening. This, most of them said, was like nothing they'd ever known before. There had been a curious trajectory about their mornings. They had awakened that day to the unusual sounds, and they had been then merely puzzled. By the time they breakfasted, they had become concerned. The Christians among them had gone off to their churches, feeling moderately alarmed. After matins, they had ventured back out onto the streets, by now in droves, and they were, at least privately, in moods that were at first quite agitated, and then, as the thunder wore on, very apprehensive indeed. The director noted with the dispassion of a trained observer a distinct racial difference in public attitudes to the events. The Dutch, who called in to see him, appeared to be outwardly calm, the men displaying either the equanimity of their long experience in the Orient, or else the public stoicism, the stiff upper lip, the code of pardon that they felt appropriate to their standing as proudly indifferent colonials. The native Javanese, on the other hand, seemed to be much more deeply concerned, with many frightened and, in more than a few cases, quite terror-struck. To the Javanese and Sumatrans, and especially to the coastal people called the Sundanese, who were and still are a very distinct group well known for their mystical beliefs and deep piety, an event like this out in the Sunda Strait was heavy with suggestive power. In their view, the eruptions showed that the spirit of the mountains, the widely feared Orang Aliye, had for some reason been made angry, was now roaming abroad, was breathing fire and smoke, and displaying his displeasure. Such a happening could only bode ill for all. Most of the colonials officially and instinctively disapproved of the natives' superstitions, and Van der Stock himself was icily dismissive. And yet, some of the wiser old colonials did wonder about such things. At least, they would wonder after the terror was fully over many months hence, what had it really meant? For the moment, though, what was of much more immediate concern was the need for a widespread battening down of the hatches, with the inhabitants of western Java and southern Sumatra waiting to see just what nature, or the gods, had it in mind to hurl down at them. For the next 2 days, they had a great deal to keep them anxious. The little South Sumatran town of Ketimbang is at the best of times a dreadfully vulnerable place. Not only is it on a funnel-shaped bay where the spring tides can rush in most dangerously, not only is it sited on mangrove swamps and mudflats, ready to be inundated by every rising of the waters, but it also lies directly beneath a small volcano called Rajabasa. The mountain's flanks rise steeply to more than 4,000 feet, immediately behind the cluster of coastal houses and their tiny fishing port. Willem Beierink, the colonial controller, who had been one of the first to note the ominous initial rumblings 5 days before, was in time to be tested harshly by what happened. His wife kept a close watch on the entire affair from beginning to end and kept a detailed journal. In May, or so it seemed from her detached and insouciant tone, the early stages of the eruption seemed to her more inconvenient than truly alarming. When it all began on the Sunday morning, she'd been taking the air on her veranda, idly watching the ships that passed by up and down the ever-crowded strait. She would derive hours of pleasure from watching the long-distance boats fresh out from Batavia, their sails all slipped and bellying in the breeze as the craft began scudding her way towards Europe. There was always a great deal of shipping to see. The view from the controller's elegant little house was magnificent. But then, without warning and jolting her from her reverie, another hammer blow, another set of violent tremors started up once more. "We were much bothered," she wrote. "The vibrations were best seen in the water barrels kept stored in the bathroom," she said, "since their surfaces rippled prettily with every detonation." She took up her diary and began to make notes of yet another subterranean interruption. She was writing all this in her journal when, quite unannounced, a prahu arrived and was hurriedly slithered up onto the mud, its long bamboo outrigger propping it to one side. 8 frightened-looking fishermen leapt from it, ran up the beach and made straight for Beierink's office. They jabbered excitedly in a mixture of Sundanese and Pidgin Dutch. They were from the island of Sebesi, they said, and they'd all been together that morning on Krakatoa. They had gone there to gather wood for boat building. They had been felling trees and stacking cords, chatting contentedly among themselves when suddenly they heard what they assumed was a burst of cannon fire from a warship. It was probably, they thought, a Dutch man-of-war exercising out in the strait. At first they paid little attention and carried on felling trees until there was a second terrifyingly loud report which made them dash down to the beach to see what was going on. As soon as they got there, they said, they saw the very beach itself split wide open and jets of black ash and red-hot stones roaring out into the air. They fled in terror, running for safety and then diving into the sea to swim out to where they had left the boat. The tide had risen dramatically, they said. Just an hour beforehand they had been able to wade to the mooring place. The controller's wife, by all accounts a sceptical and somewhat hard-bitten lady, was in no mood to listen to these excitable natives. She told her husband acidly that it was simply impossible for a beach to erupt. He was ready to agree to shoo the fishermen away, but then Beierink's superior suddenly arrived from his own headquarters further up Lampong Bay, in the little port city of Telok Betong. He was a Mr. Altier. He was then just a month away from the end of his 5-year posting as resident of Lampong, and was keenly eager to do the right thing and to leave with his reputation in good standing. He had just been telegraphed by the Governor-General, he told his junior. He'd been ordered to investigate a situation that could be heard and was now fast alarming the entire Batavian citizenry. Whatever the risks, he and Beierink must leave for Krakatoa, and they must do so immediately. And so the two men jumped into the official government launch that had brought the resident down from Telok Betong, and they bumped out into the rough waters of the bay, turned due south and sped through what turned out to be, and quite bizarrely, wave upon wave of floating pumice stone. They headed past the two islands of Sebuku and Sebesi that hid Krakatoa from their view. They dodged past masses of pumice and charred and floating trees. They were drenched by massive sudden waves, enveloped in clouds of choking gas and a miasma of falling ash. It's 24 miles from Ketimbang to Krakatoa. It took the men 4 hours to bring the coastline of the island into some kind of view. And though we don't know from their records whether the pair actually landed, we do know that they spotted exactly what it was that had so alarmed the fishermen before them. The northernmost beach of Krakatoa was indeed belching fire and smoke, and the smallest and most northerly of the three cones of the island, and which had long had the name of Perbuatan, was in the process of erupting, the roaring and belching and noise of its concussions getting stronger with every minute. The two officials turned tail, their worries for their own safety finally taking precedence over Mr. Altier's concern for his colonial career. They sped back through an ever more dense coagulation of hot grey pumice, making their way through the fast-falling tropical night to the coast and the Ketimbang telegraph station. Shortly before midnight, they sent a hurriedly composed message in Morse code, marked for the eyes of the Governor-General only. Within minutes came a reply. The resident of Bantam, on the western side of Java across the strait, reported seeing essentially the same thing. Flames, belches of fire, rafts and floating rock, ash falls. And he had heard it, too, the noise of what was undoubtedly an eruption, memorably terrible, and sounding to him like the crashing, screeching roar of a great ship's anchor chain that was being endlessly raised, its shackles banging hard and rustily against some vessel's sides. More evidence had meanwhile been streaming in from all quarters. The northbound sailing vessel Conrad, enveloped in an inferno of choking ash and dust, and in which the ambient temperature was at least 10 degrees higher than it had been elsewhere, had battled for well over 5 hours to pass through a near impenetrable field of floating pumice, its grey masses packed tightly like ice floes. Forests on the flanks of Krakatoa were seen to be ablaze. The doctor on board the southbound Sunda saw bright red clusters of fire like sheaves of wheat bursting from the column of smoke that poured from Perbuatan. He saw a new crater on the island's western side spurt a torrent of dark red fire, and later that evening, when 30 miles away from the eruption and almost in the open ocean, he asked a sailor to drop a bucket into the sea. The man pulled back up only pumice with barely any water at all. Peculiar, ominous sounds had been heard up in Singapore, more than 500 miles to the north. An English plant collector named Forbes, working more than 1,300 miles away in Timor, reported a sprinkling of ash around his grass hut. There were some fanciful reports as well. Someone reported that all the chronometers in the government observatory in Surabaya, in East Java, 500 miles away, had mysteriously jumped forward, and that the time ball by which ships in harbour might learn the hour had somehow stuck on its shaft. These later turned out to be nonsense. On the other hand, the usually circumspect Lloyd's agent, a man who in Anya owned a small pension, the Anya Hotel, down by the docks, turned in what sounded like an entirely responsible report. He scribbled a hasty telegram to his head office in Batavia for eventual onward transmission to the insurance exchange in London with the first summary of what he was seeing. Krakatan, that's what he wrote, casting forth fire, smoke and ash, accompanied by explosions and distant rumblings. Only later in the day was he able to write a rather more discursive account. So now, more than a week after the initial feeble quiverings had first been felt at the lighthouse, the cause and the source of it all had at last been seen and in action. It was now well beyond any doubt that the long-dormant, but apparently not extinct, island of Krakatoa was in an entirely new phase of its geological development, was now active once again, and was fast starting to erupt. What would happen next, the scale of the catastrophe that would envelop the region in a little more than 10 weeks' time, would positively beggar belief. And yet, 2 days later, and after its alarming opening salvo, the island quietened down again. A thin plume of white smoke and steam still rose above the Purbawatan crater, hinting that something was continuing to roil beneath the surface, but outwardly all looked tranquil once again. The low, triple-cratered island and its neighbours slumbered hotly once more, surrounded by a calm and deep blue sea, and when viewed from the ports of West Java became once more near invisible, compared to the hazily violet and distantly looming silhouettes of the truly enormous old volcanoes of Sumatra. The two peaceful days went past, then three. After a fourth, the Governor-General decided that if all was really quiet, it might now be prudent to go and take a closer look at Krakatoa, both to see what had already transpired and then, more importantly, to see if such an event looked likely to take place again. The first ever government inspector to visit the island had done so just 3 years before. He was a mining engineer from Doorn, named Rogier Diederik Marius Verbeek, and he would make his name in later years with his monumental 546-page study of the Great Eruption of 83. But in July 1880, when he had first set foot on the geologically completely unknown terrain of the island, he was quite unknown, a specialist only in the coal mines of East Borneo. He found himself near Krakatoa while on temporary attachment to Holland's splendidly named Imperial Beacons and Coastal Lighting Service, which had a small ship named the Egeron, bound for an inspection of a lighthouse on a clifftop with the rather less regally named Flat Corner. On my return trip to Batavia, I was able to pay a short visit, he wrote, to the islands in the Sunda Strait, of which Krakatoa, he said, was by far the most interesting. He sketched the four islands of the group. He took a small boat to the northern end, close to the soon-to-be-notorious 400-foot peak of Purbawatan. He chipped away with his hammer at what was evidently a recently made lava flow. He took samples of what he afterwards decided was a rather unusual dark andesitic obsidian, a glassy, evidently very rapidly melted and cooled rock that in this case had, most interestingly, a highly acidic character. The composition of this rock was in fact much more than simply interesting. It was highly suggestive of its having come from a melt of the half-oceanic, half-continental mix of materials that had been made deep inside what geology now knows to be a typical subduction zone. But Verbeek could not possibly have been aware of this, nor could he have made any but the most primitive surmises about the rock's observed and rather curious acidity. The very concept of a subduction zone was wholly unknown back in the 19th century, along with all the mysteries of seafloor spreading and continental drift. They were a reality that was only to be understood almost a century later. And in any event, Verbeek was not going to be allowed to make any further observations, since the crew of the Egeron's pinnace were champing at the bit, eager to steam on home, and they kept blowing their siren to bid him stop hammering. He was frustrated too. It turned out to be far too difficult for him to pass along the Krakatoa shore through the dense jungle that stretched clear down to the sea. There was no time, he admitted lamely, to collect any rock samples from the southern part, that is, of the peak. But to what he had collected, he added dryly, little did I think that the places where I hammered rocks would disappear altogether 3 years later. 3 years later, Dr. Verbeek very nearly missed what would be for him the culminating event of his geological career. He had left for Utrecht to supervise the making of a geological map of southwestern Sumatra, and only by the greatest good fortune did he come back to Java on leave in the summer of 1883. He actually completely missed the first part of the eruption. Even so, his ship steamed past the fire-torn and half-ruined island in July, 6 weeks after these first eruptions had begun. His absence forced Governor-General Sjakob to choose in his place one of his deputies, an obscure mining engineer named A.L. Skuurman, to make the hazardous first journey across to Krakatoa. Skuurman's mission was simple, to see what might be seen and to make an official report on whether anything devastating was likely to happen again. There was no problem in finding a suitable boat for Mr. Skuurman. A combination of a widespread popular fascination with what had taken place and the eagerness of local shipowners to satisfy that fascination, the force of the market, in other words, were to supply him with exactly what he needed. The British chaplain in Batavia, the Reverend Philip Neal, was to write later that since the spectacle was regarded by the Dutch as a curiosity, an agreeable excursion was to be made to the island by one of the mail steamers trading in the Java Sea. The Netherlands Indies Steamship Company was the first to recognise the tourist potential of the event and came up in short order with one of their vessels, the 1,239-ton Governor General Loudon. On the Saturday, representatives from the company tacked up notices in the Harmony and the Concordia clubs, advertising the delights of such an agreeable excursion and announcing a competitive price of only 25 guilders per. By Sunday morning, they had closed their lists, such was the press of interest, and on the Sunday evening, the party set off. It was 17 days after the first vibration, only a week after the first eruption. The Loudon was filled to its capacity of 86 passengers, and the government's Mr. Schuurman was very much among them. After steaming through the night towards a purple, fiery glow that could be seen in the middle of the Sunda Strait, dawn finally broke. "The view of the island," Schuurman wrote, "was fantastic. It was bare and dry, instead of rich with tropical forests, and smoke rose from it like smoke coming from ovens. Only the high peak of Rakata had some green left, but the flat northern slope of Purbawatan was covered with a dark grey ash layer, here and there showing a few bare tree stumps as meagre relics of the impenetrable forests which not too long ago covered the island. Horrible was the view of that sombre and empty landscape, which portrayed itself as a picture of total destruction rising from the sea, and from which, with incredible beauty and thundering power, rose a column of smoke. The cloud was only several dozens of metres wide at its foot, wheeling to a height of 1,000 to 1,200 metres, while widening, then rising from there to 2,000 to 3,000 metres in height, and in the meantime fading in colour, delivering its ash to the eastern wind, which, falling as a dark fog, formed the background of the tableau. The Loudon's captain, T.H. Lindemann, kept well away from the island, but he loaned Schuurman a small boat in which the engineer and a small party of curious daredevils approached the northern end of Krakatoa. The beach was covered with pumice. They struggled on shore through ash into which they sank up to their calves. "Following the tracks of the most courageous," Schuurman wrote, "or perhaps the most stupid, we climbed inland with no further obstacle than the ashes which gave under our feet, the route being over a hill from where we could see, emerging from the ash, some broken tree trunks, showing signs that their branches had been violently stripped off. The wood was dried, but nothing indicated that it had been alight or smouldering. No leaf or branch could be found in the ash, and it is therefore likely that the deforestation must be attributed to a whirlwind." The foolhardiness of the explorers knew no bounds. They climbed the crater, knowing how dangerous and unpredictable it had to be, and stared down in amazement into the deep, dish-shaped basin. Its bottom, Schuurman noted, was covered with a dull, shiny crust that occasionally emitted a rosy glow, and through which a powerful column of smoke escaped with what he then admitted was a truly frightening noise. "The clouds of smoke," he wrote, "appeared to break through as with difficulty but with unmatched force, and they seemed to flee in numerous but closely linked, tremendous bubbles whose internal friction caused the turning and convoluting movement of the clouds in the lower part of the column of smoke. Only at the edges of the point of eruption could the exhalation of steam from a number of cracks and gaps be observed." The men stayed for most of the day, burning the soles of their shoes, coughing and spluttering in the clouds of ash, occasionally darting for shelter when the crater burped out a greater-than-usual bubble of smoke and sulphurous gas. And then, just after 6 o'clock, the tropical darkness began to fall, Krakatoa being just 6 degrees south of the equator. Captain Lindemann sounded the Loudon steam horn to urge everyone to get off the island. One passenger, a Mr. Hamburg, stayed a few minutes longer to take photographs. Then everyone pulled out. "We started our return trip to Batavia at 8 o'clock in the evening," Schuurman ended his official report by noting, "thankful for the beauty and for a spectacle which made a deep impression on all, and an unforgettable one on most." For the next 8 weeks, all seemed quiet, so quiet that, even though technically speaking the eruption was still going on, with smoke still screeching from the Purbawatan crater and ash blowing high into the skies, visitors to Batavia, unless they have made inquiries, might have failed to hear of its existence at all. The geologist H.O. Forbes, pleading for information about this unknown period of Krakatoa's life, added that many of the ship's reports that had come in from this period seemed to have been written either with the mind bewildered and confused by the terrifying incidents amid which the officers found themselves, or from the after-recollection of the events, of which under such circumstances the important dry facts of time, place and succession are liable to be unconsciously misstated. One seemingly reliable report which did come to light, though half a century later, was from a young Liverpool seaman named R.J. Dalby, who in June was aboard the barque Hope, 6 months out from South Wales, bound for Saigon. While his vessel called in at Anyer for telegraphed orders, this was the day before ships' radios, of course, Dalby was given shore leave, and he took a canoe across the strait. The view on all sides, he remembered for a radio audience in 1937, was a real paradise, a profusion of vegetation rising from the seashore to the summit of hills several thousand feet high. I well remember one particular evening, just at the time when the land and sea breezes were at rest, the very atmosphere impressed one with mystical awe. It was enhanced by the subtle scent of the spice trees, so plentiful on the island, and, to crown it all, the sweet yet weird and melancholy chant of some natives paddling their canoe close in to the dark shore. There were three of us in the boat, and we rested a long time trying to take in the strange grandeur of our surroundings. It was at this time that we noticed a long, straight column of black smoke going up from the peak of Krakatoa Island. Was Dalby's recollection new evidence, perhaps, that by June the high peak of Rakata had now joined Purbawatan in erupting? Certainly a second crater had opened up later on that month. After a stiff wind had died down on the 24th of June, people on the Javan coast could see quite clearly that two separate columns of smoke were rising and that the most northerly of the two was rising majestically. The controller of Ketimbang, the doughty Mr. Bayerink, who first paddled out to the island in May, went back again in July and found two craters. But the more northerly was not on Rakata, but at the foot of the insignificant peak in the island's centre, Danan. Dr. Verbeek himself then saw Krakatoa on the 3rd of July, as he passed by on his way back to Batavia from Europe. One must suppose he knew nothing about what had just taken place, since while Krakatoa had been busily erupting, he had been sunning himself, radioless, somewhere between Gibraltar and Suez, aboard the eastbound packet vessel, the Princess Mari. The last time he had seen the island was in 1880. Now, in the dark of the small hours, he could see very little more than a vague red glimmer on the vessel's port side. And finally, on the 11th of August, a Dutch army captain named H.J.G. Ferzenaar, who had been ordered to prepare a survey of the island for the Military Topographic Service, landed and spent 2 days. He went alone. The local governor, unable to keep his promise, refused to go, and all the other officials he approached were frankly too timid. Ferzenaar found a bewildering variety of signs that the island might be readying herself anew for something quite spectacular. There were now at least three craters erupting. One, which he thought looked especially potent, was on the southern side of the mid-island peak, Danan. All told, he counted 14 vents in the rocky surface, fumaroles, one would call them now, from which greyish or pink smoke was rising. Most of these vents were also on this highly unstable-looking southern flank of Danan. He paddled his prahu around the eastern corner of Krakatoa, turned around the northern headland, passed on the outer side of the small sliver of an island on the northwest side, and then called it a day. Heavy smoke made visibility difficult. Navigation, especially in a vessel without power, was exceptionally trying. He drew a map which showed as much detail as possible, including the tiny spots and streaks of red from which the new eruptions were beginning. This small and handsome map would have to do. Any proper survey of the island has to wait until later, he wrote, because measuring there is still too dangerous. At least, I would not like to accept the responsibility of sending a surveyor. A large portion could be mapped from other islands, but I consider a survey on the island itself inadvisable. His caution was well-founded. Captain Ferzenaar was, as it happened, the last human soul ever to set foot on Krakatoa. His map represented the final time that anyone would be able to see the entire 15 square miles of tropical island, an island which, when complete, had sported people and forests and wild animals and visitors and history, and that had existed in this place for at least the previous 60,000 years. The good captain sailed his tiny craft away from Krakatoa on the evening of the 12th of August. 2 weeks and one day later, most of the island that he had drawn suddenly exploded. Its billions upon billions of tons had turned into vapour and had disappeared from the surface of the earth forever. Chapter 6. A League from the Last of the Sun. The first that the outside Western world knew of the extraordinary events that were starting to unfold in the distant and exotic East was a 19-word entry, close to the bottom of the second column of page 12 of the Times of London, on the morning of Thursday, the 24th of May, 1883. It appeared just below a story about a police raid on a suspected betting ring in a pub in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, and just above an announcement by the London police that the number of paupers known to be in town, exclusive of lunatics in asylums, was 52,032 indoors and 37,898 on the streets. There were advertisements in columns beside the entry inviting readers to buy Negro Head gin for 13 shillings and sixpence a gallon, John Brinsmead's pianos for 35 guineas, Moyer's mulligatawny soup, Epps's cocoa, or a brand still familiar today, Rose's lime juice cordial. Wedged in between the two gripping police sagas and between the intimations of the prosperity and epicureanism of the newspaper's Victorian readership, but with a journalistic economy that verged on the terse, the newspaper then announced, "Volcanic eruption. Lloyd's agent in Batavia, under date of May 23rd, telegraphs, strong volcanic eruption, Krakatoa Island, Sunda Strait." It was perhaps appropriate that the first news of the explosion of an island in the middle of the sea came first through the agency in both senses of the Society of Lloyd's. This was an organisation that by now was quite venerable, it having been more than two centuries since London merchants met in Lloyd's Coffee House to discuss the coverage of risks to their far-flung fleet of cargo ships and set up a mutual aid arrangement to cover themselves in the event of any losses. Lloyd's had become formally incorporated by Parliament in 1871 and was, by the latter half of the century, respected as the world's oldest and premier society of insurance underwriters for ships. In that capacity, the body employed or retained scores of agents, or sub-agents as they were formerly known, at almost every port and capital city in the world. The Lloyd's agency system, which still exists, had been set up in 1811. In port cities around the world, most often in the little streets close by to the docks, there still will be an office with a brass plaque outside, or perhaps the enamelled crest with its cross and anchor badge and the words "Lloyd's Agent" picked out in scarlet. To fill the posts of agents of the Committee of Lloyd's has long been, from the Lloyd's point of view, quite simple. Men have invariably been selected for being no more than resident and well-established at the place concerned and of high commercial status and integrity. From the applicant's point of view, it was less easy. The privilege of appointment was considerable. Many applied, and only a very few could be chosen. The task of an agent was in good times one of great simplicity, in bad times one of formidable complexity. Agents were initially bound by their contract to do no more than to collect and to transmit to the corporation information of likely interest to the Lloyd's market and to insurers worldwide. But in those times, more frequent then than now, when ships went down, or where there were collisions or strandings or piracy or arguments over cargo, it turned out that they were there also to settle suits, to adjudicate disputes and to pay just claims on the policies of insurance that were underwritten by the syndicates of Lloyd's. Although that first message about Krakatoa reportedly came from the Lloyd's agent in Batavia, the colonial capital, it did so simply because of reasons of protocol. It was thought more appropriate to have the formal report of a major event like this come from the agent, in this case a Scotsman, a Mr. McColl, who was based in the nation's heart, even if he was only transmitting second-hand information about an event that he himself did not see. He may not have done. One of his deputies, however, most certainly did. For Lloyd's, which had, and still has, a truly worldwide presence, also had as agent a man on the spot, someone with a bird's-eye view of Krakatoa and all that was going on there, too much of a bird's-eye view, as it would later turn out. He was named Mr. Schuit, and he was the Dutch owner of the seafront Anya Hotel that he had conveniently set down close to the docks in the small Javanese port of the same name. The nature of Lloyd's business demanded that they have a presence in Anya. Not only was it a bustling little coastal port in its own right, but it was the place where the northbound vessels on passage for Batavia would stop to take on their pilot, and where southbound vessels would drop him. Anya, principal pilot station of West Java, was the first port the newcomers would see in the island, their first landmark after passing the light on Java Head. So it was a natural and necessary place for Lloyd's to have a man. And Mr. Schuit had been chosen to fulfil the task for which Lloyd's paid him a modest retainer, mainly because of his view. His inn possessed a large wooden veranda overlooking the sea, and he and his guests would come of an evening to sit in lounging chairs there to gaze at the remarkably lovely spectacle that was spread out before them, the island-filled, mountain-ringed, sunset-spectacular Sunda Strait, with the seemingly endless passage of ships sailing, or steaming, this was 1883 after all, along it on their various ways between the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea. This latter was what convinced the Lloyd's Committee that Schuit was the ideal man for them in the town where they particularly needed to employ one of the best. Schuit was fascinated by the passing trade, and so were his guests. He bought and mounted a large brass telescope under his porch so that he could identify the more distant vessels. Since with this he could see and had learned to read the signal flags, there would be no marine radios for almost another 30 years, he could pass on messages to owners and agents as asked. He'd look out especially for the distinctive arrangement of three flags which read ZD2, the shorthand that was known by all agents and which meant simply, "Please report my passing to Lloyd's, London." He knew the Anya harbour-master, who kept him fully up to date about all the vessels that docked to load or unload cargoes, or which simply stopped by to bunker, to victual or de-rat. Schuit would thus send to London, almost every day, the names of ships that stopped, copies of the signals he had received, and statistics about the number of quintals of pepper or pickles of nutmeg or mauns of this, uncatties of that, which had passed across the Anya quays. And as well as all the shipping and commercial information, he would also from time to time send to London entirely unrelated information of likely interest, and of which the entirely unexpected burst of activity on Krakatoa was certainly a prime candidate. It was of interest to the underwriters back home, the names, not merely because of the fascination provided by the explosion of any big volcano, but because this particular volcano lay almost directly athwart the main navigational passage of the strait, and so would be bound to interest any master whose vessel might soon be making passage in those waters. In many ways, the mechanics of Mr. Schuit's job was, in the closing years of the 19th century, changing fast. The ships themselves were altering their appearance drastically. Sail, as a means of moving them across the oceans, was steadily giving way to steam. Wooden hulls were being replaced by steel, copper nails by iron rivets. The Suez Canal had opened for business, making passages to and from Europe more rapid and less risky. There was a steady growth in traffic, with more cargoes as world trade increased, and with ships from more nations. Congestion in the shipping lanes reflected the ebb and flow of global business and global politics too, and, as with the German warship Elizabeth, on her way home from a posting off China, of the rise and fall of distant empires. And the ways in which Mr. Schuit and his like were transmitting their reports was changing too. For most of the previous 70 years, he and his predecessors would have sent their signals to Lloyd's by hand of messenger, the packages of bundled slips going back to London on the very homebound ships about which men like Schuit were reporting. But now, ever since mid-century, technology was beginning to make the lives of all kinds of far-flung intelligence gatherers, Lloyd's agents, diplomats, traders and foreign correspondents among them, a good deal easier and much more efficient. For the previous 10 years, Schuit had been sending all of his messages from Anya, including the information about the first explosion of Krakatoa, and which the still extant records show was transmitted at precisely 3:47 a.m. on the 23rd of May, by way of two related and newly invented devices. The first, which we've already seen first claimed to the East Indies in 1856, was the electric telegraph. The second, and which was to play a highly significant role in the unfolding of the Krakatoa story, was the submarine telegraph cable. This underwater cable arrived in Java after many fits and starts. The first one failed after sitting on the ocean bottom for only a month. But by 1870, 13 years before Mr. Shuit needed to get his story out to London and as quickly as possible, the international cable connecting Batavia was working well, and his message was received only a relatively short while after he sent it. It took an event like Krakatoa's eruption, which astonished and mystified an entire educated world, to underline the real revolution that this new technology was visiting upon the planet. True, other events had already been recounted by means of the new machinery, and its utility, to commerce, diplomacy, and news-gathering in particular, was in no doubt. But with the explosion of Krakatoa came a phenomenon that in time would come to be seen as more profound. This eruption was so enormous an event, and had so many worldwide implications and effects, that for humankind to be able to learn and to know about it, and in detail, within days or even hours of its very happening, changed the entire tapestry of the world's view of itself. It would not be stretching a point to suggest that the global village, the phrase is modern and was coined by Marshall McLuhan in 1960, referring to the world-shrinking effects of television, even pre-satellite, was essentially born with the worldwide apprehension of and fascination with the events in Java that began in the summer of 1883. And Agent Shuit's first telegram to London was one small indication of that revolution's beginnings. Though what the Times had published was brief in the extreme, what Agent Shuit actually wrote by hand was considerably longer and more discursive, and it started: "On Sunday morning last, from 6 to 10 o'clock, there was a tremendous eruption, with continuous earthquakes and heavy rain of ashes. On Sunday evening and Monday morning, it was continued. The eruption was distinctly seen here until 9 o'clock this morning, and smoke was seen until 12 o'clock. Afterwards it cleared up a little, and at this moment the air is clouded again. Captain Ross reports from Anyer that on May the 22nd he was sailing near Java's first point and tried to get Prinsen Island in sight, but found that it was surrounded by clouds. Then he steered from Krakatoa, but found it to be the same there. The captain observed that the lower island or mountain situated on the north side of Krakatoa was totally surrounded by smoke, and from time to time flames arose with loud reports. Fire had broken out in several places, and it is very likely that the trees in the neighbourhood have caught fire. The mountain of Krakatoa had been covered all over on the north side with ashes." Shuit wrote this dispatch in English, since that was the language in which Lloyd's conducted its business, and he marked it to be sent to London and copied to the Lloyd's agent in Batavia. He was evidently a night owl, since it appears that he wrote his message in longhand and on the prescribed telegraph forms long after his dinner, and in fact very early on the morning of Wednesday the 23rd of May. It must have been pitch dark, with no one about, when he took the completed sheets down to the small white stucco building that housed the ever-open office of the Dutch East Indies Post and Telegraph Service, and handed them to the clerk. Since the message was marked urgent, the duty officer sat down at his wooden brass Morse tapper and register, and with the lightning speed and near total accuracy, aside from reading Shuit's handwritten Krakatoa as Krakatan, for which good operators are renowned, dispatched the signal to his opposite number in Batavia. From the Batavia telegraph office at the corner of Postway and Kirkway, or what is now Cathedral Street, the message then underwent a form of mitosis, with one copy of the signal going to the Lloyd's office and agent, just down the street in central Batavia, the other going straight on to London. The one version sent on to London was dispatched from Batavia, or possibly originated at Anyer, of this we cannot be sure, at 3:47 a.m. on the Wednesday, in London late on the evening of the Tuesday. The message took some while to reach London, one reason why the first published reports of the eruption appeared in the Times not of the Wednesday morning, as might be expected, but that of Thursday, the 24th of May. It took its time to make its way from Batavia to London because of the mechanics of late 19th century communication. It began its long journey by first going to the north of Java up to Singapore, and doing so by way of the newly made and wholly revolutionary invention, the submarine telegraph cable. There's a nice irony in the story of the building of submarine telegraph cables, a business that had only begun in 1850 when the first cable was laid between Dover and Calais. What allowed the industry to flourish, something which really only happened when cables ceased their infuriating habit of breaking in mid-ocean and when they could be relied upon to work and carry their signals without interruption, was the discovery of a handsome evergreen tree called Isonandra gutta, from which oozed a rubbery, workable and waterproof substance that was soon to be called gutta percha. A London firm called S.W. Silver and Company discovered that gutta percha could be extruded like rubber and could be made to cover copper wires that would then be proof against water. The firm's directors promptly changed the company name to the magnificently sonorous India Rubber Gutta Percha and Telegraph Works Company, and under that rubric established factories that began to spin hundreds upon hundreds of miles of armoured, waterproof telegraph cable for ships to lay deep down on the ocean floor. The moment the electric telegraph was invented, wrote a manual of the day, so gutta percha, the very substance it demanded, was discovered. By 1865, the Gutta Percha Company was producing submarine cables as fast as the world was able to connect itself, and they were happily transmitting electronic messages hither and yon at great speed and with near total security. It was this guarantee of security and privacy that was their real value. The disruption of wars that kept breaking out like wildfires all over Europe was making the cables that passed over land risky means, indeed, of sending messages anywhere. And the irony? Well, it so happened that the handsome evergreen tree with its rubbery sap was found in abundance in just one corner of the planet, in Borneo, Sumatra, and in Java. Gutta percha, so critical for communication, became in the 1860s a major East Indian export, just like pepper, quinine, and coffee, and an export that was to have an impact on the technological development of the outside world that was as important as it turned out to be invisible. And further, though this substance that made cables work so well just happened to be found in Java, it was 20 years after the technology was first used that it was employed to connect Java with the rest of the world that was already using it. Mr. Scheut's signal thus passed along the 557-mile-long gutta percha-covered cable that had been laid by the converted cargo ship Hibernia to Singapore in 1870. A cable had first been laid along the route 11 years earlier by the Dutch government, but the technology of 1859 was primitive, the demand was slight, and when it broke, as it did after a few weeks, no one from the government ever bothered to repair it. On the second occasion, the combination of commercial demand and market forces and new technology succeeded where the pioneering had failed. A brand new private cable was laid on the orders of the British Australian Telegraph Company, designed not so much to connect Java with the outside world as to allow the vastly powerful Eastern Telegraph Company to connect its Trans-India lines to the burgeoning populations in Australia and New Zealand. And so the Hibernia laid the connecting cable to Batavia. Together with her sister ship, the Edinburgh, she then laid another from Banjawangi in eastern Java to Port Darwin in northern Australia. Engineers connected the two by a landline that ran the length of Java itself, and when finally in 1872 the Australian government completed its own landline across the continent, then London and Sydney could exchange messages with each other with consummate ease and with near total commercial security. So Mr. Scheut's Morse-coded message reached Singapore by way of the British Australian Company's gutta percha and jute twine-covered four-strand copper cable, the fastest and most secure thus far designed. The signal was then amplified and sent on its way towards London. It here had two choices. It could either go slowly and relatively insecurely via the long chain of landlines that had been established in mid-century when telegraphy had first begun to expand, or it could go via Eastern. A customer could in those days specify on the telegram forms which cable should be used and pay the costs which that particular cable company charged. specify via Eastern, and it made most of its long journey by sea. Leave the cable routing box blank, and the message went the long and slow way, and for most of its length, by land. But the land journey had a fine romance about it, even so. From Singapore it went up the Malay coast to Penang, and then by a short sea journey to Madras. Thence, ever westward, it progressed, by way of cities still known, or by towns obscure, long forgotten, or with names no longer used. The lines of creosoted pitch-pine telegraph poles took the cable to Bombay. Then, after a switching centre, it became an armoured cable and dipped beneath the Arabian Sea to reach Karachi, then rose back on pole-supported line to the village of Hermak in Baluchistan, to Kerman, Tehran and Tabriz in Persia, to Tiflis in Georgia, on to Sukhumi on the Black Sea coast, along the Corniche to Kerch in the Crimea, to Odessa, up across steppes and coal fields to the Polish city of Berdichu, with a population of 52,000, which in those days before Hitler were almost all Jews, and finally via Warsaw, Berlin and the North Sea port of Emden, beneath the sea for one final time before making landfall in East Anglia, and thence by telegraph pole for the final 50 miles to London. A telegram sent thus could take a week to reach its destination. But if the operator marked the message via Eastern, then it went swiftly and securely beneath the sea. By now, 35 years after the first insulated cable had been dropped from a ship called the Princess Clementine, moored in Folkestone Harbour, and had been connected to a boat 2 miles away, and a message successfully sent between the two, since then the undersea cable had become fixed in the public consciousness. Alfred Lord Tennyson had written a hymn to the romance of idea of coded voices hurrying along the ocean floor, and so had Rudyard Kipling, whose brief poem, The Deep Sea Cables, remains among his best loved. The wrecks dissolve above us, their dust drops down from afar, down to the dark, to the utter dark, where the blind white sea snakes are. There is no sound, no echo of sound in the deserts of the deep, or the great grey level plains of ooze, where the shell-bird cables creep. Here in the womb of the world, here on the tie-ribs of earth, words and the words of men flicker and flutter and beat, warning sorrow and gain, salutation and mirth, for a power troubles the still that has neither voice nor feet. They have wakened the timeless things, they have killed their father time, joining hands in the gloom a league from the last of the sun. Hush! Men talk today o'er the waste of the ultimate slime, and a new word runs between, whispering, let us be one. The undersea cable connecting Singapore with London, after passing first by land in those days to Penang, crossed the Bay of Bengal to Madras, hopscotched across India, and then plunged into the Arabian Sea on the long passage from Bombay to Aden. It was then put ashore briefly at Port Sudan, nosed up to its receiving stations at Suez and Alexandria, crossed the southern Mediterranean to the island of Malta, through the northern part of the Mediterranean to Gibraltar, between the Pillars of Hercules to Carcavelos, on an Atlantic headland 10 miles to the west of Lisbon, up to windswept Vigo on Spain's western Galician coast, and finally it headed north, sheltered deep below the storms of the Bay of Biscay and the western approaches, to its final landing place at Porthcurno on the southern tip of Cornwall in England. After this, the messages did their final 200 miles by land, along conventional wires that were carefully tended to, since they carried the international and imperial traffic of the hallowed and respected Eastern Telegraph Company. The signals would arrive at the receiving room of what was called London Station around 3 hours after they had been sent out from the Morse Tapper in the faraway east. In the case of Scheut's Anya message reporting the eruption of Krakatan, sent from Batavia at 3:47 a.m. on the Wednesday night, the signals would have arrived, subtracting the 8-hour time difference between London and Java and adding the approximate 3 hours of transmission time, at about 10 p.m. on the night of Tuesday the 22nd of May. They had been marked urgent. They were decoded from their Morse and they were sent immediately to the delivery address, the Foreign Intelligence Office at Lloyd's. And then, as it turned out, they were sent to the Times. This paper, which was then more than now quite intimately involved with the British establishment, had nonetheless a cosy arrangement with Lloyd's. any signal deemed to be of likely interest would be passed promptly across to the paper's foreign news editor to see if it might indeed be of any use. News of the eruption arrived too late on Tuesday to be of any use, but once Mr. Scheut's excited cable about explosions and ashfalls and eruptions of fire had been read on the next day, Wednesday the 23rd of May, their worth as hot news was immediately evident. Scheut's message was read in full by the duty editor. It was edited heavily, since only 7 words of it were actually published in the paper, and for some inexplicable reason the word Krakatan, itself an error, more probably the telegraph operators than Mr. Scheut's, was changed to the similarly eccentric Krakatoa, with an O, a W, and an A. The cable was received early enough to be published in all editions of the paper of Thursday the 24th of May, including the Scottish edition that was printed first, and as well as the final London edition, which was printed last on the best quality paper at around 3:30 a.m. and was delivered to all the embassies and palaces and government offices of the capital. By mid-morning, all the loyal readers of what was then known as the Thunderer came to learn of the event, and slowly but surely, since the volcano was to figure in the news dozens more times before the year was out, began to incorporate the name of this distant island, hitherto quite unknown, into their daily lexicon. And as it was incorporated into the lexicon, so it became, in short order, a prominent feature of received culture all over the world. Krakatoa achieved this happy status thanks in part to another of the great creations of the era, the news agency, based in London, and which was created by a German-Jewish businessman who, with great prescience, saw news and its fast delivery as a saleable commodity, and who gave it the name to which his immigrant parents had changed theirs, Reuter. In 1815, it had taken the news of Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo 4 days to reach readers in London. When Napoleon died on the Atlantic island of St. Helena 6 years later, most Britons remained in ignorance of the fact for the following 2 months. But 20 years later, the telegraph had been invented, and by the 1840s its lines were spreading across Europe like the tentacles of kudzu. It was not long before entrepreneurs like Julius Reuter, then a small-time newspaper publisher in Paris, decided that this new medium could allow news to be sped from place to place electrically, and then sold to those in need of it, just like any other commodity. Speed, being first with the news, getting the scoop, beating the competition, was the most important thing to Julius Reuter. In those early days, he was often too far ahead of the technology and had to come up with inventive solutions. To get news from Paris to Brussels before the telegraph link had been fully completed, for example, he used pigeons. The French news would be telegraphed to the border town of Aix-la-Chapelle, the messages then transcribed and taped to the legs of 45 specially trained Reuter pigeons, and 2 hours later would arrive in the Brussels city centre. It was a series of stunts like this, as well as his agency's reputation for factual reliability, that enabled Reuter to win contract after contract to supply news from all over the world and to all the world. From the 8th of October 1858, when his service properly began, the list of successes and scoops under the Reuter byline became legendary indeed. Reuter was, for example, 4 days ahead of the London papers with his account of, important then at least, the King of Sardinia's address to the opening of his parliament. He beat everyone with the news of the Austrian defeat at the Battle of Solferino. By 1861 he had 100 correspondents working worldwide. During the American Civil War, with the Atlantic still not connected by cable, he arranged for telegraph news to be rowed out to boats at remote ports on the America's eastern shore, places like Halifax and St. John's and Cape Race, and collected a week later by rowing boats sent out from Ireland. When President Lincoln was shot on the 14th of April, 1865, the news was carried aboard the SS Nova Scotian, taken off by whaling boat when the liner closed on Londonderry, and was telegraphed to London by Reuter in time to be published in the subscribing newspapers of the 26th of April, 12 days after the tragedy. By the time of Krakatoa's eruption, the entire East was fairly well connected with the newspaper reading West, as Reuter had already so amply displayed by writing in timely fashion about the arrival of the Admiral Perry and his American warships off Tokyo and the subsequent restoration to the chrysanthemum throne of the Japanese Emperor in 1868. Timely, but not instantly, since Japan was not to be fully connected with the worldwide telegraph system until the Danes laid a cable between Tokyo and Shanghai in 1872 and connected the newly re-emergent state with their Great Northern Telegraph Company line that went between St. Petersburg, Copenhagen and Paris and on to London. From the time the Danes had completed this cable, all of the major eastern cities, Shanghai and Peking, Manila and Tokyo, Saigon and Rangoon, were hooked into the system. They had become a part of the fast-growing network of international cables, and since being firmly hooked into this network, had become beneficiaries of, as well as contributors to, the worldwide news-gathering operation of Reuters. And Batavia was connected as well. It had a Reuters office, and in 1883 it had a stringer, a retained freelance who fed such news as he found into the agency wires. He was named W. Brewer. He would turn out to be the point man who would send most of the properly factual reports of the eruption for distribution around the world. In May, though, the first that Reuter heard of the eruption came not from Mr. Brewer, but from London, and via the Lloyd's telegram. The agency got it right, but it got it late, a full day late, such that when the rest of the world was given news under the Reuter byline, it was already the 25th of May. The largest Dutch newspaper of the day, the Rotterdam-based Nieuwe Rotterdamsche Courant, published it on that Friday morning, having to be content with the undignified reality that a British newspaper had managed on the Thursday to scoop a Dutch paper with a story about an event in a Dutch colony. Reuters, however, peddled its story hard. The same paragraphs about the first eruptive event and that had appeared in the Times of the 25th of May, a story that was now fleshed out by Mr. Brewer in Batavia and which had the volcano's name settled as Krakatoa, with T-O-A at the end, were to be found, translated into the vernacular where necessary, in all that Friday's major newspapers in America and Southern Africa, in India and France and Germany. It was thanks to the combined agencies of all those involved, to Samuel Morse, to the directors of the India Rubber and Gutta Percha and Telegraph Works Company, to the Eastern Telegraph Company, to the Committee of Lloyd's, to Reuter, and to the small network of eager correspondents in Anya, Batavia and London, that this first remarkable story started to be told. It was the first ever story about a truly enormous natural event that was both about the world and was told to the world. Part of the planet's fabric had been ripped asunder, and part of that same planet, the part connected by cables and telegraphs and which had access to printed newspaper, was now being informed of the event. And the very process of relating the dramatic happenings, especially in the weeks and months that followed, would enable all who heard and read and understood it to share in the cruel intimacy of the moment. Millions of people, hitherto unknown to one another, began to involve themselves for the first time ever in the process of looking beyond their hitherto limited horizons of self and started to inhabit an entirely new and outward-gazing world that these storytelling agencies and this event that they were relating were unwittingly helping to create. The story of Krakatoa had a small beginning, seven newsworthy words buried well down in the pages of a single London newspaper. As the summer of 1883 wore on, it was to become a very much greater story indeed, and when it was over, 3 months later, it was to have implications for society, for the laying of the foundations of Mr. McLuhan's global village that have reverberated in a far more important way and for far, far longer than anyone at the time of the event could ever have possibly supposed. Chapter 7. The Curious Case of the Terrified Elephant. The final Monday of July 1883 was one of the last quiet days ever to be experienced on Krakatoa, an island which now had precisely 4 weeks remaining before it was blasted out of existence. It was also on that day, the 30th of July, that John and Anna Wilson's Great World Circus, long expected and universally welcomed, finally arrived in Batavia town. The performers and their animals had sailed in on the liner from Singapore, and on this particular occasion, for they'd been to Batavia many times before, the canny Scotswoman Miss Wilson well knowing they could be certain of a grand colonial crowd, they promised their audiences the staging of amazements and delights in an atmosphere of more sumptuous comfort than could possibly be imagined. 2 years before, members of the audience had complained they were too crowded and too hot. So for this visit, Mrs. Wilson had brought with her from New York a brand new tent, a giant she had christened the Mammoth. As the guy men hauled up the immense acreage of bleached canvas on the west side of the Königsblein, so passers-by gasped at what they saw and heard. "Room for 5,000 seats," the posters exclaimed. "Real gas lamp illuminations," blared the barker's horn. "Unbelievable new attractions," proclaimed the newspaper advertisements, including, the first time ever seen in the Orient, Cannonball Holtum from Denmark and his incredible death-defying feats of courage and fearlessness. This time, the Batavians said to themselves as they handed over their 1 guilder coins for tickets, and as they watched the final preparations being made, Wilson's great circus truly was going to be the greatest that Java had ever seen. The circus was to be, or so everyone thought at the time, the crowning glory of what had thus far turned out to be a delightful summer season. The volcanic grumblings and growlings over to the west in the Sunda Strait continued, true, but now that the initial surprise of the May eruption was over, the fact of all the fire and smoke and occasional tremblings of the earth had become part of the reality, an established routine. No one really gave it a thought. It meant no more than the occasional tremor might mean today to someone in Tokyo or Los Angeles or along the San Andreas Fault. Batavians made jokes about it all. It was not going to be allowed to cause any disruption of the gay social round. Though one of the Batavia papers, the East Indies edition of the Algemeen Dagblad, did sound rather exasperated in June when it remarked sourly, "What musical entertainment there is can hardly be enjoyed because of all the shaking noises of the doors and windows caused by Krakatau." Nonetheless, the social year that had begun so splendidly in February with that King's Day dance at the grammar school, and about which the papers still talked in the summer, so successful was it said to have been, rolled on unstoppably. In mid-May, for example, there was horse racing held up in the mountain cool of Beitensorg, and a costume ball was held in the Steward's Hall on the Sunday morning of the 2-day meeting, Governor-General Sjakob naturally lending his august presence. Then there was a soirée dansante held in the Batavia Plant and Animal Garden on the 27th of May. Usually this would be an uneventfully happy evening, but as it happened, a small shadow was cast over it, too, not, however, by Krakatoa. Most of the guests had been hoping to see the Royal Bengal Tiger that, famously, had been presented to the garden earlier in the month by a German philanthropist named Mr. Schroeder. But the garden announced it had neither the space nor the wherewithal for housing this very large and fierce animal, and the curator ordered it put on the next boat to Melbourne, disappointing the dancers who had hoped it might enliven their evening. Any sense of chagrin that might have been felt by the dancers at the loss of their tiger was quite probably offset by another much more practically consequential announcement that was also made in May. The 985-ton British steamer Fiado, under contract to the Australian Frozen Meat Company, had, its owners announced to the papers, been fitted with up-to-date refrigeration equipment and would begin a regular service to Batavia and Singapore, bringing cargoes of frozen sides of beef, lamb, pork and poultry. The first such cargo arrived on the 20th of July, and to judge from the newspapers of the day, which greeted the docking of the Fiado as they might greet the unexpected arrival of a monarch or a star, a wave of gastronomic ecstasy promptly swept the colony. The Australian meat, never seen before, turned out to be of extraordinary quality. Not even a large and well-bred Balinese ox could compete with this, a local gourmand was quoted as saying. Meat was no longer a luxury. Henceforward, every European in the colony could eat as well in Java as they once had in Amsterdam. Perhaps now, even better. The epicentre of Batavian gaiety in that summer of 1883 was the newly renovated and extended, indisputably grand white marble building of the Concordia Military Club at the south side of Waterloo Plain, directly across from where the Governor-General had his palace. That year, the Concordia ranked marginally ahead of the Harmonie, which was admittedly the older of the city's 2 great social clubs, and which remains the better known today, even though the Harmonie's building was torn down in the 1960s, like that of the Concordia, the part of modern Jakarta in which it stood retains its name. At the time of the Krakatoa events, the fabric of the Harmonie was looking somewhat shabby, and the club was suffering from a temporarily declining membership. Far better balls and soirees were being held at the much swankier Concordia, where, to the delight of most Europeans who were invited, they were marked by a lavishness that often bordered on the decadent. For example, there was a masked ball held at the Concordia on Saturday the 28th of July, just before the arrival of the circus. 300 couples came by horse-drawn carriage or in the back-to-back conveyance known as a dos-a-dos. The gardens were illuminated with Chinese lanterns. There were obelisks lit with piped gas, and a Turkish kiosk with a sky-blue cupola had been built for the outdoor band. And inside, under the ornate ceiling and gas chandeliers, within walls groaning with portraits and mirrors and statuary, beside rare plants, flowers, and soft-coloured veils of gauze, and upon a floor of polished teak squares dusted with French chalk, they danced until the sun came up like thunder, as in the tropic east it was wont to do. The women, the finest of all Batavian high society, were seen to be wearing dresses that, to the more matronly onlookers and chaperones, were positively outrageous. "So short," they chorused next day. "So delightful," the men reminisced. "If you want to enjoy the sight of beautiful pink satin shoes with fine ankles moving on the dance floor," someone wrote, "go to the masked ball at the Concordia." The masks and costumes were as various as could be. One lady came dressed as a swallow, with a headdress and wings made of feathers from Anya songbirds, birds that had lately been flying, in other words, in the turbulent volcanic airs of the Sunda Strait. Another, La Madame la Diable, had black wings and gilded horns and a silk dress in black and red, adorned with images of Lucifer. There was a Carmen, a Louis XV escorting an Italian farm girl, buxom in gingham and Genoa lace. There was a Toreador, a consistory of monks, and a group of British sailors from a passing Royal Navy warship, whom everyone thought were in fancy dress, but were simply in full fig, officially. And as if this display were not enough, in the centre of the ballroom was a fountain gushing not water, but pure eau de cologne. This was by way of an experiment. A flower vase was used as the centrepiece, and from deep in the lush enfoldments of its blooms gushed fountains of perfumed water, which, when mingled with the scents of the assembled dancers, with the cigar smoke and the rich aromas of spices from the rice staffel, made for a symphony of olfactory delights that, the newspapers gushing too, found simply too overwhelmingly wonderful for words. Then came August, and with it at last the circus,